Imagine, for just a second, that you are a visionary in the tech world.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. So you've spent the better part of a decade building this wildly successful communication app.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we are talking millions, perhaps even billions of active users across the globe.
That's a lot of users.
Exactly. And your platform is, universally praised for its lightning-fast speed, its slick interface, and most importantly, its ironclad, uncompromising commitment to user privacy.
Right, the privacy aspect is
It
huge.
is. So you feel pretty good about your contribution to the digital age, and you decide to take a well-deserved weekend trip.
Makes sense.
You step off your private jet onto the tarmac in France. You're breathing in that crisp European air, ready for a few days in Paris.
Sounds lovely,
It
honestly.
does, right. But instead of a waiting limousine and a polite driver, you are met by a literal wall of heavily armed police officers.
Oh, wow. Talk about a ruined vacation.
Seriously. And they aren't asking for your autograph, they are placing you under arrest.
Wait, really? For what?
Well, as the rights are being read to you, the charges start to sink in. They aren't arresting you for, like, tax evasion or a regulatory misstep or jaywalking.
Okay, so what is it?
You're being charged with complicity in international drug trafficking, massive money laundering operations, and the distribution of child sexual abuse material.
That is, I mean, those are incredibly heavy charges.
Unbelievably heavy. You are thrown into a detention cell for days, and when you finally see a judge, your bail is set at a staggering 5 million euros.
5 million, that's insane.
Yeah. And your actual crime? Simply building and maintaining the app that other people you have never even met use to commit crimes.
It sounds like the inciting incident of some like cyberpunk thriller, but it's the exact reality of what happened in the real world.
It really is.
Yeah. That scenario is the very real, very tangible catalyst for the conversation we are having today. We are looking at the August 2024 arrest of Pavel Durov, the enigmatic founder and CEO of Telegram.
It sent absolute shockwaves through the tech industry.
Oh, completely.
It terrified the legal world, and honestly, it should terrify anyone who has ever sent a text message they wanted to keep private.
Definitely. Which brings us perfectly into the mission of our deep dive today.
Let's get into it.
We are exploring a truly fascinating, deeply researched academic article titled Prosecuting Communication Services Providers as Crime Facilitators, a Cautionary Tale.
I love that title.
Right. It's authored by two incredibly sharp legal minds, Janjap Orlemans and Sophie Royer.
Orlemans and Royer, right.
And rather than just giving us a dry legal brief, they use this Durov arrest to highlight a seismic fundamental shift in how global law enforcement operates.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
What exactly was the old playbook, and why are they pivoting away from it? Because, the way Orlemans and Royer describe it, it sounds like the police are just completely exhausted.
Exhausted is a great way to put it, honestly. For decades, cyber policing was entirely reactive.
Like waiting for something bad to happen first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was an endless, mathematically unwinnable game of whack-a-mole. You spend 6 months tracking down one individual hacker in a basement.
Right.
You finally arrest them, and in the time it took to put the handcuffs on, three more hackers have popped up on a different forum.
Oh, man. So frustrating.
It is completely unsustainable.
Yeah.
So law enforcement had an epiphany.
It was.
Instead of chasing the individual users who are committing the crimes, why not target the infrastructure that makes those crimes possible?
Ah, I see. Go after the source.
Yeah. They decided to go after the communication service providers themselves, labeling them as potential criminal accomplices, or, as the official terminology goes, crime facilitators.
I really want to emphasize why this matters to the person listening right now, walking their dog or commuting to work.
Yeah, it's super relevant to everyone.
It is. Because if you rely on any encrypted app for your privacy, whether you're a journalist protecting a source, a business owner protecting trade secrets, or just, a regular person who doesn't want tech companies mining your personal conversations, your fundamental rights are directly caught in the crossfire of this new strategy.
That's the crux of it.
Right. If the government can treat the builders of secure platforms as accomplices to the crimes committed on those platforms, the ripple effects are going to touch every single person holding a smartphone.
It's a massive escalation in state power.
Right.
And Orlemann's and Royer's core research question is incredibly timely.
What exactly are they asking?
They essentially ask this: to what extent do fundamental human rights constrain this new strategy of law enforcement targeting the communication service providers themselves?
Because the rules of the game have entirely changed.
Totally. Law enforcement agencies, heavily pioneered by the Dutch police, have looked at their old playbook and basically tossed it in the shredder.
To understand why police are taking this drastic, almost desperate route, we have to look at the deep systemic frustration they face when investigating modern cybercrime, right?
Absolutely. Orlemann's and Royer detail what I like to call the toxic triad for law enforcement.
The toxic triad. I like that. What is it?
It's anonymity, encryption, and jurisdictional nightmares.
Let's break those down, starting with anonymity.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about using a fake name online, right?
Far from it. I mean, in the physical world, if someone robs a bank, they leave fingerprints, they're caught on camera, they speed away in a car with a license plate.
Right, there's a physical trail.
Exactly. In the digital world, criminals use advanced techniques to obscure their digital fingerprints, their IP addresses.
Yeah, they do that.
They route their connection through multiple encrypted proxies. They use virtual private networks or VPNs. Or they use the Tor network.
Which bounces their signal around the globe, right?
Exactly. It bounces around so many times it becomes practically impossible to trace back to their physical keyboard.
Which leads us right into the second hurdle, encryption.
Oh, yeah. The big one.
I feel like this is a term we hear all the time, but we rarely stop to define what it actually means for a police officer trying to solve a crime.
In the context of this discussion, we are primarily talking about end-to-end encryption.
Okay, so how does that differ from the old days?
Well, in the old days, if the police had a warrant, they could go to a telecom company, clip a physical wire, and listen to a phone call. Or they could intercept an SMS text message as it flew through the air.
Like a classic wiretap.
Right. End-to-end encryption breaks that entire model. When you send a message on a truly encrypted app, the message is scrambled mathematically on your actual device before it ever leaves your phone.
Wait, so it travels through the internet as complete garbled noise?
Exactly, just complete gibberish. It only gets unscrambled when it reaches the specific device of the person you are texting using a unique mathematical key that only their phone possesses.
So even if the police have a warrant and they force the internet service provider to hand over the data packet they intercepted in the middle, it's useless to them.
Totally useless.
They can see that person A is talking to person B, but they just have a digital soup of random characters. They can't read a single word.
It renders traditional wiretaps practically obsolete.
Wow.
And then you add the third and arguably most infuriating hurdle for police jurisdiction.
Right, because the internet doesn't have borders.
Exactly. In traditional policing, jurisdiction is simple. A crime happens in London. The London Metropolitan Police investigate.
Makes sense.
But consider a modern ransomware attack. The victim is a hospital in London. The hacker orchestrating the attack lives in a non-extradition country, say, Russia.
Oh, boy.
And the server they used to launch the malware is physically located in a data center in Brazil. And the cryptocurrency they demanded as a ransom is being tumbled through servers in a dozen different countries.
It's like trying to solve a murder where the weapon is invisible, the suspect is a ghost, and the crime scene is literally scattered across 20 different sovereign nations.
That's a great way to put it.
I mean, a London police officer can't just digitally cross the border into Brazil and seize a server without navigating months of complex international legal treaties, assuming Brazil even agrees to help.
And by the time the paperwork is signed, the criminal has already moved their operation to a server in a different country.
So they're just constantly chasing shadows.
Yeah. The territorial restriction of enforcement jurisdiction makes reactive policing nearly impossible.
Which is why they change tactics.
Exactly. This toxic triad is why the old strategy failed, and it is exactly why Dutch law enforcement decided to pioneer a completely new proactive approach.
Right. Instead of swatting individual mosquitoes, they decided to drain the swamp.
I love that analogy. They formalized it into something called the CSAE model. That stands for Collect, Store, Analyze, Engage.
I really want to dig into this CSAE model because the paper makes it sound like a total paradigm shift.
It really is.
Let's start with the first three letters. Collect, store, analyze. This sounds like they are just vacuuming up data.
It is essentially data-driven policing on a scale we haven't seen before. Instead of reacting to a single report of a crime, they proactively use investigatory powers to collect massive amounts of data from the infrastructure itself.
Like breaking into the servers.
Yeah. For instance, they might hack into a server hosting an underground drug marketplace or seize a server hosting illegal forums.
Oh, wow.
And they don't just grab the specific data about one suspect. They take the entire database. They store this bulk data on highly advanced forensic platforms, and then they unleash analysts and algorithms on it.
So they are looking at the entire ecosystem.
Exactly.
They aren't just looking for one drug dealer. They are mapping out who the top vendors are, where the money is flowing, who the administrators are, and how the whole digital cartel operates.
Precisely. It reveals the hidden architecture of the criminal enterprise. But the final step, the E for Engage, is where this strategy gets truly radical.
Okay, tell me about Engage.
Because Engage goes far beyond traditional law enforcement outcomes like arresting a suspect and putting them on trial. Orlemans and Royer detail how this phase includes highly disruptive, almost psychological interventions.
Psychological interventions? Like what?
Well, they're designed to destroy the trust within the criminal ecosystem.
Give me some examples of that, because the paper mentions things like naming and shaming and cease and desist visits, which sounds completely bizarre for a cyber unit to be doing.
Imagine you are a teenager who went onto a shady forum to buy a tool to knock your rival offline in a video game, a minor cyber attack.
Right, some script kiddie stuff.
Under traditional policing, you'd likely fly under the radar because you aren't worth the resources to prosecute.
Yeah, they have bigger fish to fry.
But under the Engage strategy, local police might physically show up at your front door with your parents standing right there.
Oh my.
Hand you a formal cease and desist letter and say, we know exactly what you bought, we know your username, and if you do it again, you are going to jail.
That is incredibly invasive, but I mean, I can see how effective it would be. It completely shatters the illusion of anonymity.
Exactly. It terrifies them.
What else do they do?
They utilize warning splash pages.
What's that?
When police seize the domain of an illicit marketplace, they don't just take the site offline so it returns a boring 404 error.
Okay.
They replace the homepage with a massive, intimidating police crest. So a criminal logs on expecting to buy stolen credit cards, and instead, they are greeted by a message from Europol essentially saying, this site has been seized, we have the data, we know who you are.
Oh, wow. That would create instant panic.
Absolute paranoia among the user base. They also proactively notify the victims whose data was found on those servers, letting them know they've been compromised.
So the ultimate goal isn't just to secure convictions in a courtroom. It is the total systemic disruption of the criminal infrastructure.
Exactly.
But to disrupt that infrastructure, they need a target to aim at. That brings us to this specific concept of the crime facilitator. When law enforcement agencies use that term, who exactly are they talking about? Are they talking about Google and Apple?
Not initially, no. According to Europol and the research analyzed by Orlemans and Royer, crime facilitators are primarily defined as providers who deliberately turn a blind eye to the reality of their platforms.
So they know what's going on.
Yeah, they are characterized by a complete failure to engage in basic know your customer or KYC procedures.
Which means they don't verify who is using their service.
Right. They allow users to register completely anonymously. They happily accept untraceable payments like certain privacy-focused cryptocurrencies or even like literal suitcases of cash.
Suitcases of cash, seriously.
Yeah. And crucially, they systematically ignore lawful requests for information from the police.
The sources specifically categorize these facilitators into two main buckets, bulletproof hosting and crypto communication services.
Yes.
Let's break those down. What makes a hosting provider bulletproof?
Bulletproof hosting is exactly what it sounds like. It is a server farm, a data center, that advertises sometimes very openly that they will protect your data from everyone, including law enforcement.
So they're bragging about it.
Oh, yeah. They are the digital equivalent of a shady landlord in a bad neighborhood who tells you, I don't care what you do in the basement. I don't care what smells are coming out of the windows. As long as you pay the rent in cash, I will never open the door for the cops.
That's a vivid image.
It's accurate. They host malware, command and control servers, massive spam networks, and the most vile content on the internet. And their entire business model is built on ignoring subpoenas.
Wow. And the other bucket, crypto communication services,
yeah,
refers to those custom-built, heavily modified phone ecosystems designed exclusively to evade police surveillance.
All right.
We're going to dive deep into those in a minute. But first, let's look at what happens when law enforcement actually points this new CSAE model at these facilitators.
It gets intense.
The article outlines an incredible timeline of takedowns, starting with purely cybercrime-focused operations.
Right. The authors highlight several massive coordinated global strikes. For instance, Operation Power Off.
Operation Power Off. What was that?
This was a multinational effort targeting DDoS for hire services.
Let's do a quick explainer on that. What is a DDoS attack and why would someone hire one?
So DDoS stands for Distributed Denial of Service.
Okay.
Imagine you own a small retail store and a competitor pays 1,000 people to stand shoulder to shoulder in front of your front door.
So no legitimate customers can get in.
Exactly. The store is effectively shut down. A DDoS attack does that digitally. It floods a website or a server with so much fake, malicious internet traffic that it crashes, denying service to real users.
People were hiring this out as a service.
Yeah. Criminals were setting up websites where anyone with a credit card could pay $20 to launch one of these attacks against a rival gamer, a school website, or a competing business.
That's crazy.
Operation Power Off targeted the infrastructure providing that service.
And then there was Operation Endgame, which targeted ransomware botnets. What is a botnet in this context?
A botnet is an army of zombie computers.
Zombie computers?
Yeah, hackers infect thousands, sometimes millions, of everyday devices. Everything from laptops to smart refrigerators to security cameras with a specific type of malware.
And the owners have no idea.
The owners usually have no idea they are infected. The hacker can then send a command to all these zombie devices simultaneously to carry out a massive attack.
Like what kind of attack?
Often distributing ransomware that locks up hospital or corporate networks until a ransom is paid. Operation Endgame was the largest ever operation against the servers controlling these botnets.
The scale of these operations is just mind-boggling.
It really is.
They also mention Operation Stream, which went after the server infrastructure hosting child sexual abuse material.
Right.
But there is a really fascinating detail in the research regarding the outcome of these specific cybercrime operations. The police seize unbelievable amounts of data, thousands of servers across dozens of countries, but what happens to the people actually running the servers?
That is the vital distinction here. In these early, purely cybercrime-focused operations, the providers of those services, the people running the server farms, rarely ended up going to prison.
Wait, really? Why not?
Because the focus of the operations was almost entirely on disruption, taking the infrastructure offline, seizing the domains, and deterring the users.
Ah, I see.
The operators themselves often walked away, largely because proving they had the criminal intent to commit the specific crimes happening on their servers was too legally complex.
But that strategy had a ceiling. Because taking down a server full of stolen credit cards or spam bots is one thing.
Right.
But the Dutch and other European agencies eventually looked at this incredibly effective disruption model and had a chilling realization. They asked, if we can hack into a server hosting a botnet and take it offline, why can't we do the exact same thing to the server hosting the encrypted text messages of international drug cartels? Here's where it gets really interesting. Because that is when the strategy violently pivoted away from just cyber geeks in basements to targeting serious, violent, organized crime.
And that pivot changed the entire landscape of European criminal justice. The article details the takedowns of massive crypto communication networks.
Like which ones?
We are talking about watershed operations against platforms like Enetcom, SkyECC, EncroChat, and IronChat.
Wow.
These weren't just messaging apps. These were the nervous systems of global organized crime.
I really want to make sure we understand exactly how audacious these operations were. We aren't talking about the police getting a warrant to tap one drug dealer's phone.
No, not at all.
How did they pull off something like the EncroChat hack? Because if the messages are end-to-end encrypted, as we discussed earlier, seizing the central server in France shouldn't give them anything but scrambled noise.
That's exactly the problem.
So how do they actually read the cartel's text messages?
That is the million-dollar question, and it is a marvel of modern digital forensics. You are right. Seizing the server wouldn't break the encryption.
Right.
So French and Dutch investigators did something unprecedented. They didn't break the math. They bypassed it. They managed to infiltrate the central update server of the EncroChat network. Then they silently pushed a malicious software update, essentially government-created malware, to all the physical EncroChat phone devices across the globe.
Wait, so the criminals thought they were just downloading a standard security patch for their secret phones.
Yep.
but they were actually installing a police wiretap directly onto their own device.
Exactly. And because the malware was on the device itself, it could read the text messages on the screen before they were mathematically scrambled by the encryption algorithm.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant.
And it could read incoming messages after they were unscrambled. It also silently copied the passwords and the GPS locations.
That is unbelievable.
For months, European police were literally reading the live day-to-day text messages of hitmen, drug lords, and arms dealers in real time. It was like breaking into the post office and reading every single piece of mail as it was being written.
The audacity of that is staggering. And unlike the cybercrime operations, where the main goal was just taking the servers offline and putting up a splash page, the data secured in these cryptophone operations was immediately weaponized as evidence in court.
In a massive way. In the Netherlands alone, the authors note there are over 1,700 published legal judgments where the foundational evidence came directly from these decrypted messages.
1,700? That's a huge impact.
Yeah, they didn't just disrupt the networks. They used the infrastructure's own data to prosecute hundreds of murders, massive cocaine trafficking rings, and brutal kidnappings.
Okay, so we've established how effective it is to take down the infrastructure. But I want to step back to the legal jeopardy of the providers themselves, the people who actually build and maintain the servers.
The cautionary tale part.
Exactly. Because that is the core of Orlemans and Royer's warning. Tell me about the cyberbunker case in Germany. Because when I read this in the sources, it sounded like a rejected script for a James Bond movie.
It quite literally was housed in a 5-story subterranean former NATO bunker in the German town of Treben-Trarbach.
Wait, a literal bunker?
A literal bunker. You had blast doors, advanced cooling systems, attack dogs, and an eccentric Dutch owner who bought the bunker to set up the ultimate bulletproof host.
Okay, that is definitely a Bond villain lair.
It really is. The cyberbunker case is the textbook illustration of a provider pushing the limits of the law. They operated under a literal public slogan, stay online no matter what.
So they were basically daring law enforcement.
They openly advertised they would ignore any police requests. Because of this, their servers became a haven for the dark web.
What kind of stuff were they hosting?
They hosted massive darknet markets like Wall Street Market, which sold immense quantities of drugs, counterfeit currencies, stolen credit card data, and cyber attack tools.
So in 2019, hundreds of German tactical police finally raided this bunker.
Yep.
They seized nearly 900 servers. They arrest the eccentric owner and his technical staff. To a layperson, it seems like an open and shut case. You built a heavily fortified bunker specifically to host international drug markets. You go to jail for drug trafficking. Simple, right?
You would think so, but this is where the legal mechanics become incredibly delicate and where the article's warnings begin to materialize.
Okay, what happened?
The German Public Prosecution Office initially charged the bunker's defendants with complicity aiding and abetting in over 249,000 specific offenses committed by their clients.
Oh, wow. 249,000 charges.
Yeah.
Drug deals, fraud, hacking.
Exactly. But in a stunning turn that shocked many observers, the regional court acquitted the providers of complicity in those specific crimes.
Wait, I have to stop you there because that makes zero logical sense.
I know.
If my business slogan is stay online no matter what, and I know for an absolute fact that my massive underground server farm is currently processing millions of dollars in heroin sales and stolen identities, how on earth am I not an accomplice to those crimes?
It all comes down to the strict, deeply ingrained legal definition of criminal intent, or mens rea, in European law.
Okay, break that down for me.
German law, and indeed many Western legal systems, requires that to be an accomplice, your intent must be inextricably linked to a specific concrete offense.
A specific offense?
Yes. Having a general awareness that illegal stuff is probably happening over there on my servers is not legally sufficient for complicity.
Wait, so if I run a platform and I know some people are using it for crime, but I don't know exactly who or what, I can't be an accomplice to their specific crimes.
Precisely. Because the bunker owner didn't know the exact details of a specific drug deal, like user X is selling 2 kilos of cocaine to user Y on Tuesday at 4 p.m. He couldn't be an accomplice to that specific drug deal.
That is wild.
The prosecution has to prove that the provider intended to aid a specific act of crime at the specific time they provided the server space.
And they couldn't do that here.
No, because the cyberbunker providers maintained a layer of ignorance regarding the exact details of the individual transactions flowing through their cables. They lacked the requisite specific intent for complicity in those individual crimes.
That feels like a loophole big enough to drive a truck through. So they just walked free. They got away with it.
No. The German justice system found another route.
Okay, good. What was it?
While they were acquitted of complicity in specific crimes, they were convicted of a much broader charge, membership in a criminal organization.
I see.
For that specific charge, the law does not require you to know the details of every crime. It only requires proof that the members knew the overall aim of the organization was to facilitate serious offenses.
And building a NATO bunker to ignore the police probably counts as aiming to facilitate offenses.
Exactly. The court ruled that the entire business model of the cyber bunker was deliberately designed to shield criminals from the law. And that was enough for the organizational charge, even if it wasn't enough to pin a specific drug deal on them.
That nuance is fascinating.
Mm.
And it perfectly highlights the central legal tension that Orlemans and Royer are warning us about in this article.
The incredibly difficult tightrope walk between privacy and prosecution.
Which brings us right to the heart of what the authors call the dual-use dilemma.
The dual-use dilemma is arguably the defining conflict of the digital age.
Let's talk about that.
Well, authorities look at platforms like EncroChat or even mainstream apps like Telegram or WhatsApp, and they see a highly efficient, heavily armed tool used to disrupt global crime syndicates. They know that if they shut the platform down, the cartels go blind.
Right. But these technologies, specifically end-to-end encryption and decentralized servers, are inherently dual-use.
Exactly. They have massive, fundamental, and entirely lawful uses that are vital to a functioning democracy.
Like, my bank uses end-to-end encryption to protect my savings.
Yeah, and your hospital uses it to protect your medical records.
Journalists use it to communicate securely with whistleblowers in oppressive regimes. Dissidents use it to organize protests without being arrested by secret police.
All perfectly legal, essential uses.
So, if we decide as a society that providing strong encryption makes you a criminal facilitator, simply because criminals also happen to like privacy, we are essentially criminalizing the very concept of a locked door.
That is a perfect metaphor. And the European Court of Human Rights, the ECTHR, has taken a very strong, very clear stance on exactly this issue.
Hmm. What do they say?
The authors highlight a critical case, Kachatov v. Russia.
What happened?
In that ruling, the Russian government was trying to compel a communication provider to hand over encryption keys.
Basically asking for a master key to the locked doors.
Right. The ECTHR ruled against Russia, explicitly recognizing encryption not as a dark tool for criminals, but as a vital fundamental mechanism for protecting the human right to a private life and freedom of expression.
So they recognize that in the modern era, if you don't have encryption, you don't really have privacy.
Exactly. The court noted that encryption defends everyday citizens against hacking, identity theft, and corporate fraud.
Makes total sense.
Therefore, the mere act of offering an encrypted service or building a secure platform can never, in and of itself, be considered a criminal act or a basis for legal liability. You cannot ban the locked door just because a burglar might hide behind one.
Okay, I agree with that completely. Building the locked door is legal.
Yeah.
But what happens when a government turns around and claims that only criminals are using the building?
Oh, man. That brings us to the Bylak cases in Turkey.
Honestly, I found this to be the most chilling and dystopian part of this entire deep dive. Set the scene for us on the case of Yüksel Yeltsinkaya v. Turkey.
To truly understand the gravity of the Bylak case, you have to understand the historical context.
Okay.
In July 2016, there was a violent, bloody, and ultimately failed coup d'etat attempt against the government in Turkey.
Right, I remember that.
In the aftermath, the government engaged in massive, sweeping crackdowns, arresting tens of thousands of judges, teachers, military personnel, and journalists, accusing them of being part of the armed terrorist organization that orchestrated the coup.
A climate of absolute paranoia.
Utter paranoia. And in the midst of this, Turkish intelligence agencies discovered that many members of the alleged terrorist organization were communicating using a specific encrypted messaging app called Bylak.
Okay.
Based on this, the Turkish government made a sweeping draconian claim. They declared that Bylak had been designed and used exclusively by this terrorist group.
And what were the legal ramifications of that claim for the average citizen?
It meant that Turkish national courts decided that simply having the Bylak app downloaded and installed on your smartphone was, on its own, sufficient evidence to convict you as a member of an armed terrorist group.
I want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly. Just having the app on your phone.
Just having the app.
The prosecution didn't need to produce text messages proving you plotted the coup. They didn't need wiretaps of you discussing violence. Just the little app icon sitting on your home screen was enough to send you to prison for terrorism.
That is exactly what happened.
That is terrifying.
The government argued that because ByLock utilized strong encryption and required a VPN to access certain servers, it was inherently a clandestine terrorist tool. They arrested, detained, and convicted thousands of individuals, including Mr. Yelisinkaya, a former teacher based purely on the digital footprint of downloading and using this application.
Wow.
And that is when the European Court of Human Rights had to step in with what can only be described as a systemic legal smackdown.
Walk us through how the ECTHR dismantled the Turkish government's argument, because it feels like a crucial line-in-the-sand defense of basic digital rights.
The ECTHR looked at the government's claim of exclusive criminal use and applied basic logic and mathematical evidence.
Okay, what did the math say?
They pointed out that ByLock wasn't some hidden, invitation-only dark web secret. It was a publicly available app.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it was downloaded over 100,000 times from the public Google Play Store and up to 1 million times from other public third-party sites across the globe.
Wow. So it wasn't a secret at all?
Not at all. Yet Turkish intelligence only identified around 215,000 registered users on the server. The math simply didn't support the idea that it was a closed, exclusive loop used solely by coup plotters.
It's like claiming that only bank robbers use Honda Civics, therefore anyone driving a Honda Civic is a bank robber, despite the fact that millions of them are sold every year.
A very apt comparison. Furthermore, the ECTHR looked at the features the Turkish government called terrorist in nature, things like strong encryption, the ability to use a VPN, and automatic message deletion.
Which are super common now.
Exactly. The court noted that these are standard, highly desirable privacy features found on almost every modern commercial messaging app on the market today.
So what does this all mean? When the dust settled, what precedent did the European Court of Human Rights actually set here?
The ECTHR firmly established that a state cannot attach objective criminal liability to the mere use of an encrypted app.
Okay.
They ruled that simply finding the app on a phone does not even constitute a reasonable suspicion for a pretrial detention, let alone a criminal conviction.
That makes sense. You need actual evidence.
Exactly. A reasonable suspicion requires verifiable contextual facts like the actual content of the messages sent, or specific physical evidence that an objective observer would look at and say, yes, a specific crime occurred. The court stated emphatically that the prosecution must assess individual intent. You cannot assume everyone in an encrypted building is guilty just because the building has high security.
That distinction is so vital. It protects the user, but crucially for our topic today, it protects the provider.
Yes, absolutely.
You cannot easily hold a tech company liable just because they offer end-to-end encryption. The prosecution absolutely must prove knowledge and intent.
But as we saw in the Cyberbunker case, proving intent is incredibly slippery. It is the hardest thing to do in criminal law.
It really is. So how does a court actually pull it off when it comes to technology providers?
To answer that, Orlemans and Royer direct us to look closely at the Netherlands.
Ah, the pioneers of the CSAE model.
Right, because the Dutch police pioneered the strategy of dismantling these infrastructures, the Dutch court system has had the most practice wrestling with this exact question of proving intent for providers.
Okay, let's get into it.
Let's look at four specific Dutch cases that really map out the boundaries of liability, starting with an acquittal to see exactly where the legal line is drawn.
Okay. Set up the 2019 Maxedit case for us.
Maxedit was a major bulletproof hosting provider. In a sweeping operation, the Dutch police arrested a 29-year-old man who was an employee being paid a substantial salary by the corporate entities running Maxedit.
What was the charge?
The prosecution's case was that Maxedit's servers were heavily polluted. They were hosting massive amounts of cybercrime infrastructure botnets, spam servers, and horrific amounts of child sexual abuse material, or CSAM.
That's awful.
They charged this 29-year-old employee with complicity in distributing CSAM, arguing that by actively maintaining the servers and failing to remove the illegal content, he was a criminal accomplice.
On the surface, that makes sense. He is getting paid by a company hosting horrific material. So why was he ultimately acquitted of the complicity charge?
It all comes back to intent, specifically a very important Dutch legal concept called conditional intent, or dolus eventualis.
Conditional intent. Explain that concept to me like I'm five.
Imagine you are target shooting in your backyard and you know your neighbor's house is right behind the target.
Okay, bad idea, but I'm following.
You aren't trying to shoot your neighbor. That would be direct intent. But you know there's a substantial, highly probable risk that a bullet will go through the target and hit their house.
Right, it's a known risk.
You decide to take the shot anyway. You have consciously accepted the substantial risk that the crime will occur as a result of your actions. That conscious acceptance of risk is conditional intent.
Ah, I see. So the prosecution argued that the employee knew there was a huge risk, this terrible stuff was on his servers, and he kept cashing his paychecks and maintaining the servers anyway, meaning he accepted the risk.
Exactly. But the Dutch court disagreed.
Why?
They demanded specific evidence. They found no direct evidence that this specific employee knew CSAM was actively being exchanged by users on the servers he worked on, let alone that he actively engaged with those users to facilitate it.
So he was just doing his job blindly.
Well, during the trial, the defendant proved that whenever he personally stumbled upon such material, he immediately reported it to his employer, who was the designated person responsible for handling abuse reports.
Oh, so he actually tried to stop it.
Right. Because there was no evidence he controlled the abuse inbox or that he consciously accepted the risk of hosting that specific material, the court ruled conditional intent could not be established. He was acquitted of complicity.
Wow.
I should note, however, he was convicted of money laundering regarding his salary because the money itself came from criminal enterprise.
Okay, so the Maxident case draws a line. Just cashing a paycheck from a shady tech company doesn't automatically make you an accomplice if you aren't the one actively ignoring the warning signs.
Precisely.
Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Contrast that acquittal with a conviction. Tell me about the recent 2025 conviction of the company known in court documents as Provider X.
This case is a masterclass in how prosecutors can successfully prove conditional intent. Provider X was another bulletproof hosting company. Their servers were the primary home of the Mirai botnet.
Mirai is famous in the cyber world. That was the malware that infected millions of Internet of Things devices, right?
Mm.
Like security cameras and baby monitors, and used them to launch massive attacks that took down huge chunks of the Internet.
Exactly. The directors and a shareholder of Provider X were charged with complicity in computer hacking because their servers were acting as the command center for this botnet.
And what was the damning evidence that got them convicted, where the Maxident employee walked free?
A mountain of deliberate, documented negligence.
Oh boy.
First, the court looked closely at how they handled abuse reports. Every hosting provider gets emails from security researchers saying, hey, this IP address on your network is doing something malicious.
Right, that's standard.
In just 6 months, Provider X received 8,012 abuse emails complaining about the botnet.
8,000, that's a lot of red flags.
And 138 of those emails specifically, explicitly named the Mirai malware.
And how did the directors respond to 8,000 warnings?
They sent automated boilerplate standard replies, or incredibly, the email simply bounced back to the sender because Provider X allowed their abuse inbox to become completely full.
You're kidding, they just let it fill up.
Yeah. Furthermore, the court looked at their KYC procedures. They allowed customers to register without providing any authentic details. Customers were literally opening accounts using the physical address 420 Hacktown.
Wait, 420 Hacktown. And the directors of this company just processed that application, saw that address, and said, looks good to me.
Yes, and they accepted pseudonymous payments in Bitcoin to seal the deal.
Unbelievable.
The court also recovered Skype chat logs, where one of the defendants explicitly typed out that he doesn't care about abuse.
Well, there's your intent right there.
But the absolute nail in the coffin was that undercover police officers recorded the defendants giving customers actual technical instructions on how to hide their malware binaries so that antivirus software wouldn't detect them.
That is just brazen. Earlier, I used the analogy of the locked door. This isn't just building a locked door.
Not at all.
This is selling a getaway car to a group of men wearing ski masks, giving them a detailed map of the bank, showing them the blind spots in the security cameras, and then throwing away their license plates for them.
That analogy perfectly captures the legal reality of conditional intent. The Dutch court ruled that by systematically ignoring 8,000 abuse reports, allowing blatantly fake registrations like 420 Hacktown, and actively advising their clients on concealment techniques, the defendants had consciously accepted the substantial risk that their infrastructure was being used for hacking.
They didn't just suspect it. They embraced it.
Exactly. That established conditional intent, resulting in their conviction as criminal accomplices.
So that covers how courts view intent in the bulletproof hosting world. But let's shift over to the Cryptophone convictions, because that involves the serious organized crime aspect, the cartels and the syndicates. Break down the Ennetcom case from 2021.
Ennetcom was one of the absolute pioneers in the major Cryptophone network space. Following a massive international operation, the founder was prosecuted and ultimately convicted of directing a criminal organization, money laundering, and forgery.
What were the phones actually like?
The court spent a lot of time analyzing the physical devices themselves. Enetcom phones were heavily customized, stripped-down BlackBerry devices. They physically removed the cameras, the microphones, and the GPS chips.
So you couldn't even make a phone call on them?
No. The phones couldn't make normal voice calls or browse the web. They could only send highly encrypted messages through Enetcom's proprietary servers. Those messages were programmed to automatically delete after 24 or 48 hours.
But the most damning feature was the help desk, right?
Absolutely. They had a 247 central help desk that could remotely wipe a phone, completely erase all its data if a user requested it.
Let me guess why they'd request that.
And those requests usually came in frantically because a user had just been pulled over or arrested by the police.
And the defendant in that case, the founder, tried to use what I call the general goods store defense.
The general goods store defense.
Yeah. The argument goes, if I own a hardware store and I sell the customer the kitchen knife and that customer goes home and uses it to commit a murder, the police don't arrest me, the store owner.
Right, right.
The Enetcom founder argued he was just a tech entrepreneur selling privacy tools. What his customers did with them wasn't his fault.
She argued that very passionately. And importantly, the Dutch court actually agreed with his foundational premise. Developing and selling encrypted phones is not, in and of itself, an illegal activity. Privacy is a right.
But they still convicted him? Where did they draw the line?
They stated that legal liability arises when the product is used exclusively or predominantly to obstruct police investigations. And the provider knows this to be true.
And how did they prove he knew?
The remote wiping feature was key. The court reasoned that wiping phones upon request, specifically to destroy evidence during arrests, proved he knew his clients were engaged in high-stakes criminal activity.
That makes perfect sense.
Furthermore, the complete lack of any personal data registration users were just random numbers, and the fact that the company accepted massive six-figure payments purely in physical cash proved the service was tailor-made for and deeply integrated into the criminal underworld.
And the Iron Chat conviction, which happened just recently in 2024, seems to follow that exact same judicial logic, but the features of the app are even more extreme.
Very much so. Iron Chat was another bespoke encrypted messaging network. The founder was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison for directing a criminal organization.
4.5 years.
The application had features that went far beyond everyday privacy. It had a literal panic mode to delete everything instantly, and a specific command code, crash me, that, if entered, would self-destruct the entire operating system of the device.
Again, crash me is not a feature you typically need to organize a neighborhood bake sale or keep your banking app secure.
Exactly. And the financial trail in the Iron Chat case was overwhelming. Approximately 90% of all credit transfers to the company's bank accounts were large cash deposits.
90%. That's insane.
The company's bank actually flagged these transactions and actively warned the provider that this volume of cash was highly unusual and unacceptable under anti-money laundering regulations.
But he ignored them.
Yet the provider ignored the bank's warnings and kept processing the cash. To top it off, the court found evidence through wiretaps that the provider was in frequent, direct, and personal contact with the leader of a major known drug trafficking organization.
Wow. When we look at these four Dutch cases, Maxited, Provider X, Enetcom, and Iron Chat, a very clear, undeniable pattern emerges about how the law is choosing to interpret intent.
It really does.
It seems like the courts are increasingly looking at basic corporate compliance failures as concrete proof of a criminal mindset.
That is perhaps the most crucial takeaway from Orleman's and Royer's analysis of the case law. We are seeing a fundamental shift in corporate responsibility.
Shift how?
Well, a deliberate lack of KYC policies, a failure to implement basic anti-money laundering measures, accepting bulk cash or anonymous crypto, and systematically ignoring abuse reports. 10 years ago, those were regulatory issues that might get you a fine.
Right.
Today, in the eyes of the court, failing to do your due diligence is viewed as concrete proof of criminal intent. By deliberately choosing not to know who your customers are, you are legally signaling to the court that you know exactly what they are doing. Willful blindness is no longer a defense. It is evidence of complicity.
And we have to be honest. This strategy is working. Which brings us to a really difficult, incredibly thorny debate because we have to acknowledge the undeniable, massive wins this strategy has produced for society.
We absolutely do. The case for the effectiveness of targeting the infrastructure is overwhelming.
It really is.
When European law enforcement took down EncroChat and Sky ECC, they didn't just round up a few street-level drug dealers. They secured access to tens of millions of live messages.
And what did they find?
According to public statements from Europol officials, in those operations alone, police were able to read messages in real time that allowed them to physically intervene and prevent over 100 kidnappings, assassinations, and instances of severe torture.
Oh my God.
They literally found soundproof torture chambers built into shipping containers, complete with dentist chairs and tools, solely because they intercepted the messages organizing them.
You simply cannot argue with those results. The strategy of crippling these crime facilitators is incredibly effective at saving lives in the short term. It is pulling the very foundation out from under global organized crime. If the cartels can't communicate, they can't operate.
But this raises an important question, and it is the exact question Orlemans and Royer want the legal community and the public to confront.
What's the question?
At what cost? What happens to the fundamental rights of average law-abiding users? As this strategy scales up from niche bunker servers to global tech companies, does it cross a dangerous, irreversible line?
That's the million-dollar question.
In the Netherlands, this tension has led to intense, ongoing legal debate, specifically regarding the police's use of bulk data.
Right, because when you seize a server or push an update to crack an entire network, you aren't just surgically seizing the text messages of the cartel boss. You are seizing the messages of every single person who used that provider, including lawyers talking to clients, journalists talking to sources, or people just having private affairs.
Exactly. It is a massive dragnet.
So what's being done about it?
The Dutch government recognized the peril here and actually established an independent evaluation committee known as Commission Koopsisi, specifically to scrutinize the legal framework and the privacy safeguards surrounding how police collect, store, and process this massive ocean of bulk data.
Because right now, the scale of data collection by law enforcement is entirely unprecedented in human history.
Exactly.
And here is where I really struggle with this whole concept. I understand taking down Enetcom or IronChat. They had a crash me button. They took 90% cash. They were clearly, demonstrably a criminal enterprise masquerading as a tech company.
Oh, without a doubt.
But what happens when this exact same law enforcement playbook treating the tech provider as a criminal accomplice if they fail to adequately police their users is applied to massive mainstream platforms. Platforms with true, undeniably legitimate dual uses.
That's the terrifying part.
What happens when ambitious prosecutors apply this logic to WhatsApp or Signal or, as we are seeing unfold right now, Telegram? Are we expecting tech platforms to act like a private, heavily armed border patrol, constantly monitoring, scanning, and judging every single message just in case a criminal slips through?
It seems like that's where we're heading.
Because if they have to break their own encryption to do that, that sounds like the end of digital privacy for everyone on Earth.
You have hit on the exact terrifying danger of overreach. And this dilemma is being radically complicated by new, sweeping technology regulations coming out of Europe.
Like the DSA.
Yes. Take the European Union's new Digital Services Act, the DSA. The DSA is designed to force tech providers to monitor their content much more strictly, to implement robust reporting mechanisms, and to cooperate much faster with law enforcement. It imposes intense, heavily scrutinized due diligence obligations on companies.
And how does the DSA interact with this criminal strategy?
It blurs the lines rapidly and dangerously. Consider this scenario. If a mainstream messaging platform struggling with billions of users fails to perfectly comply with a DSA tech regulation, maybe their abuse inbox gets backed up, or their moderation algorithm fails to catch a specific type of illegal content, could an aggressive prosecutor look at that regulatory failure and use it as evidence of conditional intent to commit a crime, just like the Dutch court did with Provider X and their ignored emails?
Wow. So missing an email in an overwhelmed customer service inbox goes from being a regulatory slap on the wrist, maybe a fine, to suddenly making the CEO an accessory to international drug trafficking and child exploitation.
That is the exact slippery slope Orlemans and Royer are warning the world about. As strict new tech regulations essentially force platforms to behave more and more like deputized police forces, the legal distance between a non-compliant tech company and a criminal syndicate facilitator shrinks to almost nothing.
That's horrifying.
If the courts accept that failing to perfectly moderate content equates to criminal intent, then every single CEO, lead developer, and founder of a major communication platform is currently sitting on a legal powder keg.
Which brings us full circle right back to the tarmac in France, with Pavel Durov sitting in a jail cell, facing exactly those kinds of charges. It's time to summarize this incredible deep dive and bring it back to the author's core, foundational warning.
To summarize the exhaustive findings of Jean-Jap Orlemans and Sophie Royer, the landscape of global criminal investigation has permanently and irreversibly shifted. Law enforcement is no longer content to just chase individual criminals through the digital shadows. They are actively, aggressively dismantling the infrastructure that allows those shadows to exist.
And the article's conclusion serves as a stark, urgent warning to lawmakers and citizens alike. Orlemans and Royer ultimately conclude that while prosecuting communication service providers as crime facilitators may be highly attractive for law enforcement because it is a brilliant, highly effective shortcut to disruption, it is legally fraught.
Extremely fraught.
It rests on a razor's edge, and it may deeply endanger fundamental human rights, especially when the tools being targeted, like end-to-end encryption and decentralized hosting, have a massive proportion of legitimate, everyday uses that protect average citizens from harm.
The stakes could not be higher, as Orlemans and Royer brilliantly articulate at the very end of their research. The continued scrutiny of cases such as the one involving Pavel Durov is essential. The authors suggest this should be paired with doctrinal analysis of criminal participation within these jurisdictions to fully understand the scope and limitations of prosecuting communication service providers as facilitators of crime.
In other words, if we don't deeply analyze the laws we are using to lock up these tech founders, we might realize too late that we've outlawed privacy itself.
Exactly.
You know, it really makes you think. It's as if law enforcement finally figured out a brilliant way to drain the swamp of cybercrime. But we're only just now realizing that by targeting the infrastructure itself, we might accidentally drain the entire ocean of digital privacy right along with it.
That's a powerful way to look at it.
And suddenly, that private jet landing in Paris doesn't seem like such a smooth ride after all. Until next time, keep your data safe and keep asking the hard questions.